Welcome to Foresight Friday Roundup, Foresight Health's podcast series for healthcare revolutionaries. Outcomes matter, customers count, and value rules. Hello again, everyone. This is Dave Berta, news editor at Foresight Health. It is Friday, June 25th. On today's episode of the Roundup, we're talking about accountable care organizations and bundled payment arrangements, two value-based reimbursement models that are supposed to move us away from fee-for-service medicine. Specifically, we're going to discuss a new study on the growth and enrollment in ACOs and a new study on voluntary versus mandatory participation in bundled payment arrangements. To tell us what the studies say about the future of value-based reimbursement are Dave Johnson, founder and CEO of Foresight Health, and Julie Murchison, partner at Transformation Capital. Hi, Dave. Hi, Julie. How are you guys doing this morning? Dave?
Summer is officially here. Long days, shorts, watermelon and lemonade. What's not to like? I'm happy.
All right. Sounds good. Julie, how about you?
Well, I've been enjoying summer with playing a little tennis, that's for sure. But my son had his first concussion this week, so I've been rocketed into the world of brain science.
Oh, goodness. Things trending in the right direction, I hope.
Yeah, it was pretty minor, but you know, you never want them to have their first one, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, good luck to him. Now, before we talk about ACOs and bundled payments, I did want to take your quick pulse on the pandemic. Dave, what do you see in the COVID case numbers that makes you hopeful? What do you see in the case numbers that makes you worried?
For over a year, Dave, among the first things I would do every morning was look at the latest distribution numbers for COVID cases, deaths, hospitalizations, and vaccinations. I stopped doing that about a month ago. So I looked again this morning, and the numbers are what I expected, very low, under 15,000 new cases per day, roughly 300 deaths, under 20,000 hospitalizations nationwide, and nationwide vaccinations for adults creeping towards 70% with at least one shot. There are many parts of the country, I'm sure, that have achieved herd immunity, but like all things American, widespread variation. Adult vaccination rates in Vermont are at 85%. That's incredible. Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Wyoming are under 50%. This new Delta variant is highly contagious and virulent, so we could see some local outbreaks. But I think, at least in the short term, we're over the hump. And so the COVID news on balance is good, not entirely out of the woods, but almost all Americans can enjoy a 4th of July barbecue without COVID worries. That feels like a victory.
Right, it does. Thanks, Dave. Julia, what do you see on the vaccine front that makes you hopeful? What do you see on the vaccine front that makes you worried?
Well, I'm loving right now all the messaging we're hearing about those who are vaccinated should go out and live their best life and make up for lost time. And we're hearing stories and, you know, all sorts of podcasts on what people are doing and people they're reconnecting with and posts of people at the airport and people on vacation again. I mean, it's actually whiplash amazing. Like Dave, I get concerned, I guess, about the Delta variant, both the hype around it that's keeping us a little bit concerned, but also the potential for continued variants that are going to have impact as this slow recovery happens. So, you know, it's causing confusion. People with J&J vaccine trying to figure out if they should actually get a booster and can they get Pfizer or Moderna. So there's consumer confusion out there for sure.
Thanks, Julie. Yeah, in our neighborhood, it's like, what pandemic? You know, few people are wearing masks. Stores aren't requiring masks. The restaurants are full. And you don't know who's really vaccinated. So for me, it's a little scary. So hopefully it'll work out okay. The other thing I think is a little scarier are these two studies we're going to talk about on value-based reimbursement. Dave, give us some highlights from this new ACO status report in health affairs and give us your take on what it means for ACOs as a value-based model moving forward.
More than anything else, healthcare reform requires payment reform. The Foresight Health audience has heard me say this many, many, many times before. We won't change the way we deliver healthcare until we change the way we pay for healthcare. The root causes of healthcare dysfunction are fee-for-service payment, divorce from value on the provider side, and administrative services only, ACO contracting, ASO contracting tied to volume on the commercial payer side. We get what we pay for, high volume and crappy, that's a technical term, outcomes. This brings us to the excellent Health Affairs blog. The number of operating ACOs since 2019 is actually declining. That decline coincided with CMMI's movement away from, quote, upside only, unquote, alternative payment models. Those programs employ the equivalent of heads I win, tails you lose incentives. Incumbents love these programs. Participation gives the appearance of real progress without necessitating change to volume-based business models. Cutting to the chase, there hasn't been much progress despite all the effort. It reminds me of Shakespeare's famous walking shadow soliloquy in Macbeth, and I'll paraphrase it. An ACO struts and frets its hour upon the stage and is heard no more. It is an exercise full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. In a report to Congress, MedPAC concludes that there are too many payment models and that they often work at cross purposes, to the point that Medicare actually ends up spending more on the beneficiaries in many alternative payment models than they would have spent otherwise. How's that for damning with faint praise? But there is a silver lining in the Health Affairs blog. They stress that payment reform isn't a goal in and of itself. Payment reform exists to improve outcomes and lower costs. In this regard, CMMI has learned a great deal about what works and what doesn't. Primary care first and direct contracting with risk are very promising. In sum, we need fewer payment models, but payment models at scale with full up and downside risk that incentivize better outcomes at lower costs. Value wins. Papa John says it best, better ingredients make better pizza. Regarding healthcare reform, better payment models drive better outcomes. It's really that simple.
Pizza, I think, was the key word there, Dave.
I know that got your attention.
It did. I'm hungry all of a sudden, and it's early.
Was that the pizza commercial?
No, that's Little Caesars.
Oh. Now we're all hooked.
Hungry.
All right. Right, exactly. All right, Julie, what surprised you and didn't surprise you in the ACO report? Does it match what you're seeing and hearing in the field?
Well, let's just remember what it was like in the healthcare industry 10 years ago, when you couldn't be an upstanding healthcare organization or an innovative solution if you didn't use the acronym ACO in every other sentence. I mean, it was like the brand in healthcare for a number of years, really. So like every other big movement in healthcare, this one is ready to have some death, have some success, and transition into the next big thing. I think that that's where we are. You know, fast forward, it's hard to be surprised by this when, as Dave said, the downside risk made the deal riskier for health systems during a time of fundamental risk of their business model, and when increasing number of value-based payment models are being released. So there's a lot more out there than there was 10 years ago. I wasn't entirely surprised by the decrease in Medicare ACOs, given the intense focus on Medicare over the last decade. And I was pleasantly surprised to see an increase in commercial and Medicaid ACOs. I think that's potentially positive, assuming that, you know, work gets done. But the reality is that ACOs are an early model on our journey towards value-based care, and they require intimate relationships among different organizations that don't always get along. So we've learned a lot from ACOs that are informing next generation models. And as Dave said, there's even a next generation ACO. But in the last decade, you know, we've digitized an unbelievable amount of data. We've created some truly incredible capabilities in companies to leverage that data in ways that allow for more consumer-centric management, innovative payment model approaches, and care delivery innovations that just weren't feasible 10 years ago when ACOs were launched. And that's not to say that the ACO is dead, but I guess my opinion is we've come a long way, and ACOs that are taking advantage of these new tools and approaches are not only surviving, but thriving. But those are very few, won't be 100%. And the others who haven't figured it out should move on.
Got it. Dave, anything to add to Julie's comments?
Well, Julie, maybe you're right. This last 10 years was a necessary phase of evolution that the industry had to go through, despite the fact there isn't a lot to show for it right now. But like you, I believe the forces are aligning that we will see a real jump in value. So I'm hopeful there. And I'm actually particularly hopeful on the Medicaid front, because where there's constrained resources, often value is the last place that the industry turns to. And Medicaid is under pressure in so many states. We're seeing some real innovation in that Medicaid risk contracting, holistic care delivery, better primary care.
Yeah, good idea. Thanks, Dave. Now let's talk about the new bundled payment study that appeared in JAMA. Julie, give us the top line findings from the study. and tell us what they mean for the future of bundled payment deals.
Well, you know, Maryland Tavener and Patrick Conway have long been critiqued for launching these value-based programs on a voluntary basis. It's been a big deal. And the issue is this. Voluntary programs are likely to see a self-selected group of hospitals and physician practices that may already have the success factors going into the program that aid their success. Or, frankly, on the flip side, they're likely to see participants drop out, of course, because it's voluntary. And those who drop out are likely those who don't think they're going to be able to make it work. So the concern is that the related results from all these will be misleading. But the team out of University of Washington this week just debunked that theory, finding that there's really no difference in spending reduction between the voluntary and mandatory bundled payment programs for specifically hip and knee replacements. Well, almost no difference. The before and after bundled payment spending difference among voluntary hospitals was $2,730. And among the mandatory hospitals was, wait for it, $2,738. You heard it right. Only $8 separated the voluntary and the mandatory hospitals. Now, that's a pretty amazing study, I have to say.
It'll get you a couple slices of pizza, that's for sure.
Maybe, depending, not in New York, maybe.
Yeah, depending on the town, right?
Exactly. But what was pretty clear from their study is that, you know, it really does make the case for bundled payments because the difference in those hip and knee replacements was about $2,700 between the hospitals that were part of some sort of bundled payment program and those who weren't. So that's good news, that's for sure. But, you know, all of this makes it sound pretty simple, and the issues are, of course, more complicated. And the group who typically tries to dig into these complicated issues tends to be someone like the Commonwealth Fund, and they've issued a report or some guidance or some commentary that outlined ways in which hospitals that are part of some of these programs can, frankly, just take advantage of the incentive structures through patient selection, choosing more costly sites of care for certain types of patients. So here's my bottom line. You've heard me say this before. Healthcare is a business. And if there's a loophole or there's a way to optimize profit, they just might figure it out. So all these programs are going to have those kinds of issues, especially in this early experimentation. So Commonwealth Fund recommends that policymakers, you know, make these programs mandatory and adjust the benchmarking methodology to reflect more robust risk adjustment. And frankly, you know, look at deeper and different alternative payment models.
Got it. Thanks, Julie. Dave, what do the bundled payment study results mean for what CMMI may do next in terms of value-based models?
I'll get to CMMI in a second, but first I want to amplify Julie's comments about healthcare as a business and the fact that it operates like a business. You know, like the police captain in Casablanca, I'm shocked, just shocked that there was no difference between voluntary and mandatory bundles. Healthcare's smartest people, and Julie alluded to this, are in revenue cycle management. Let me give you a non-healthcare example of how the payment process works to give you an idea what I'm talking about. So one of my best friends, Jay Walder, used to run Motivate, which is the company that runs all the bike share programs. So City Bike in New York, for example. And in New York, his engineers came to him one day and said they had created an unbreakable bike stand, could withstand anything that society, the elements, Mother Nature could throw at it. And Jay said, well, I believe you, but why don't we try an experiment? Let's put it in a tough neighborhood in New York for a long weekend and see if the bikes are still there when we get back. So that's what they did. And guess what? The impregnable bike stand had no bikes in it come Monday morning. Applying that to healthcare, whenever the government comes out with one of these new payment models, the smartest people in healthcare figure out how to game that model. So what Julie's saying is exactly right. As long as that is the game, how do we get the most out of the payment models? That's what the industry is going to continue to do, despite a lot of highfalutin rhetoric to the contrary. So with regard to CMMI, Liz Fowler, the director, came out recently and said that despite the evidence, they were going to move toward more mandatory models. I actually believe that's a good thing, but they have to be mandatory models with downside risk, like we've been talking about. She also wants more patient-centric care delivery across the whole care continuum. And I hate to sound like a broken record, or maybe I don't, but we aren't going to change the way we deliver healthcare until we change the way we pay for healthcare. So the payment models that CMMI needs to push forward with need to align with outcome goals. That means full risk contracting in all its flavors, full risk bundles for episodic care, capitation for population health. And in that way, we'll get the smartest people in healthcare working on value, not on how to game the system.
Mouse versus mousetrap. Thanks, Dave. Julie, anything to add to Dave's comments?
No, I think that bike story is a hard act to follow. And I think, what I've witnessed from one session with United States of Care and Liz Fowler, and just some of the activity and action that gets going on around there in Washington, is she's really listening. I think she came in thinking one thing and is just hearing so much from the industry about the importance of pressing down even harder on value-based care. So this is one of those cases where I think there's really solid listening happening.
Thanks, Julie. It certainly is challenging to change provider behaviors, isn't it? Now, as always on the roundup, let's talk about next week. Julie, what's making healthcare news next week?
Well, I have to say, I think we are getting into that period where old is new again. So I don't know that we're going to see another one of these this week, but I was amazed to see Jonathan Bush's company called Zeus. There's something very funny about that. But, we're seeing the return of folks like Glenn Tolman, the Transcarent, Jonathan Bush with Zeus. So I think we're looking to see over the course of the next few months, who are those next big success stories in early health IT who are going to come back and crush in digital health?
Hey, I'm still around, so it works. Dave, what big healthcare news is headed our way next week?
Yeah, Dave, I'm old too, and I'm ready to be new, so just like you. Well, on the political front, the big news this week was the apparent bipartisan agreement on half of the infrastructure bill, the roads, bridges, and internet. That means that Biden's American Family Plan, which addresses a whole host of human services issues, will start to receive scrupulous attention. And that's important for healthcare because what the industry calls social determinants of health, and we at Foresight like to call healthy multipliers, are embedded within the American Family Plan program. So better housing, better education, better daycare, all of those things together contribute to healthier communities, healthier people, more productive society, happier individuals. So I'm hopeful that discussion will move forward in a progressive way.
Got it. Thanks, Dave. And thank you, Julie. That is all the time we have for today. If you'd like to learn more about the topics we discussed, please visit our website at foresighthealth.com. You also can find a recording of this podcast and all our podcasts on the Healthcare Now Radio Network, iTunes, Spotify, and other streaming services. Subscribe now and don't miss another segment of the best 20 minutes in healthcare. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Berta for Foresight Health.